We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
And this is Focus. It's our morning dog program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. And we're also very pleased to have as our guest this morning, Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She has a practice here in our area. That's the Women's Health Practice in Champaign. She also continues to teach at the University of Illinois. And for a long time now, here on a regular basis, she's been a guest on the program. So we could offer to people who are listening this opportunity to talk about women's health. You know, we have a lot of different physicians on different times during the year. We have people who are general practitioners. Maybe we don't even have them anymore. Family practice people, pediatricians, and people with specialty areas. And that's why Dr. Suzanne is here to do that kind of thing as well. So she usually comes prepared to talk a little bit about things that maybe are new in her field. But also, we are here to answer questions, and I know that she will do her best. And the other thing that I always do when I have a doctor on the program is here is to try to remind people that there are some limitations because the doctor can't see you. We can't diagnose over the phone. But we hope that these programs do help to add to what, you know, people's store of knowledge. It gives a chance, an opportunity to ask some questions. So please do, if you have questions, give us a call, and I know that she will do her best to help you out, given the constraints that we operate under here. So 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And you can also send your questions by email. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, glad to have you here again.
Good morning.
We're always happy to see you.
Thanks.
Is there anything in particular here maybe you'd just like to talk about just to get started off?
Sure. There's been a lot of news. They've been talking in the news about how to diagnose breast cancer and whether there have been a number of errors in early breast cancer diagnosis. So thought that would be stirring up a lot of controversy, particularly about the diagnosis of early breast cancers, the ductal carcinoma in situs, the sort of almost pre-invasive carcinoma in situs that are being treated as invasive cancers. There also been a lot of news stories about whether home births are really safe or not safe. Not too many home births go on in our region, but thought maybe people be interested to know what stories are going on there. A number of stories about trying to increase the number of vaginal births after cesarean births. Mm-hmm. We still do offer what's called the nickname VBACs in our community, at both of our community hospitals, but in the wider community that's probably covered by our listening area. I know that some of the community hospitals have not been offering VBACs, so thought that some people might be interested in that as well. There are some new studies going on in terms of new types of birth control, new information on new studies having to do with endometriosis. I may have covered some of that in our session a couple of months ago. It does get harder for me to remember now that we're doing it every couple of months, and I do a lot of these different public speaking kinds of things. There have been some news stories about what are the best ways to pursue infertility treatments and what's safe. The FDA has just released new guidelines on what is safe for pregnancy medication treatments. Lots of news stories for a sleepy time of summer when we don't usually have very many news stories.
Okay.
So we can launch off onto any of that. I think the most controversial was this pretty long, very technical, as many New York Times scientific articles are, information about the accuracy of diagnosis of ductal carcinoma in situ. And when it comes to the diagnosis of an invasive cancer, we have to remember we're talking about an invasion. So if you think about it, it's pretty obvious that we're talking about a cancer cells that are growing unchecked through a certain particular demarcation line. And in the cervix, that's the basement membrane of the upper layers of the cervix. And in the breast, that is the cutoff is the ducts themselves. So with 95% of all breast cancers are confined to the ducts, so intraductal carcinomas, and the other 5% of breast cancers are something else. And ductal carcinoma in situ is actually abnormal cells. They're confined to the ducts, but they're actual cancer-type cells that haven't invaded, but they are actual cancer-type cells. And prior to when we used to actually not diagnose cancers with mammograms, but through lumps, we thought that these ductal carcinoma in situ were probably only responsible for somewhere between 1 and 3% of cancers. And now it grew to up to 15% of cancers. And now in some studies, ductal carcinoma in situ have been responsible for up to 30% of all breast cancers. And the growth of these, no pun intended, the increased incidence of these types of cancers has in part increased. I love to use that word growth, apparently. I need better rhetoric for this topic, apparently. But the increase in number of cases has been due to increased use of mammography all through the 90s and the, you know, year 2000 to 2010, but also due to the improvement in digital mammography technology, but also due to some improvements in how to interpret the pathology. But the New York Times article goes on to say that, wait a minute, some of the growth in incidence of this diagnosis was due to some case-by-case disagreement whether the cluster of abnormal cells were in fact benign or malignant when they used experts to reevaluate the slides. And we do always have that. I think I've talked about this a little bit. I'm participating in several large studies that look at, say, abnormal pap smears. And in our large studies, they usually have expert panels that are ultimately responsible for the final diagnosis. And when the expert panels review, they usually have to agree. And they review what we call blindly, without each other knowing what the original pathology diagnosis was or what the other experts think, and they have to adjudicate. I think in Indonesia they used to say they have to have a consensus, but not just an election. But at any rate, they do have to have a consensus, and sometimes this consensus can be briskly argued based on what some of the anatomic features are of the pathology. So it's not always so crystal clear, but sometimes it's just plain old error. And so this New York Times article apparently said that in this new nationwide study, there was a concern that up to 17% of the ductal carcinoma in situ cases were perhaps misdiagnosed and perhaps due to not enough standardization. And the reason that this is important is because in the olden days, whatever olden days were, maybe 10 years ago, maybe 20 years ago, but in the olden days, they used to not treat ductal carcinoma in situ very aggressively. It was something that we kind of watched and knew about, but they weren't very aggressive until it became carcinoma in situ, invasive cancer. But now they treat it pretty much as if it was an actual invasive cancer, and that's what the article, of course, interviews people that were treated quite aggressively. Mm-hmm. And perhaps those individuals that had been misdiagnosed and treated very aggressively could have been saved some very aggressive treatments. we now know that if you just treat with ductal carcinoma in situ, not so aggressively, we think that just with a lumpectomy, there might be actually the greatest chance of survival, but you may have more recurrent disease. So not only are these patients being given lumpectomies, but they're also being given radiation. They're also being given chemotherapy. Very aggressive treatments, expensive, potential toxicities. So there's a lot of controversy being generated. And I don't know that for our listeners, I have an exact answer. I think that, like in other areas of medicine, that it's sometimes important to get a second diagnosis. In this particular New York Times article, I didn't memorize the article here. It was a very complicated article, and I'm not 100% sure I agree with all of it. But they talk about problems with the funding of second opinions. Actually, in most of my patients, I've found that insurance companies often are willing to cover the cost of getting anatomic second opinions. In other words, sending your slides off to wherever you want to, Washington University, Northwestern, University of Chicago, Mayo Clinic, Johns Hopkins, whatever place you want to send your slides off for a second opinion. Even locally, if you've had your slides diagnosed at one hospital, you can easily have them sent to the other hospital to get the pathologist to give a second opinion. And usually that's covered as a consultation, just as you going for an appointment to another doctor would be covered as a second opinion consultation. So that is definitely available. Sometimes it may just be the way the tissue sampling was taken place, because they talk about the fact that some of these patients were diagnosed based on needle biopsies, and needle biopsies do not obtain very much tissue. They obtain a very small amount of tissue, and when you're talking about invasion, you're talking about looking how much of the tissue is involved. And I like to talk to patients when we talk about cervical endothelial disease, we like to talk about how much, for instance, the top layers are involved. And I liken it to when we chop a carrot. Sometimes you can chop it so it looks very round, or sometimes you can chop it so it looks very diagonal, and that could change exactly how much is actually involved. So we know that sampling errors can be involved. So the article's pretty revealing. If you've been given a diagnosis of ductal carcinoma in situ, I think that you would perhaps want to read it. And apparently there are 50,000 of these women in the United States that have a diagnosis of ductal carcinoma in situ. I would think that you would want to read this article with your primary care physician, because it is such a complicated article. I even found that it was complicated, and it's a topic I lecture on and talk to my patients about quite a bit.
Well, is the concern that we have women who are being told that they have cancer when they actually don't?
Yes.
So that's a concern. It seemed to me also there was a secondary concern about whether there is cancer. If there is truly cancer, then what's the appropriate way to treat? And is it possible
Correct.
That you might say, okay, yes, there is cancer here, but it is my opinion as your physician that we could just kind of wait. We don't really have to do anything right now other than continue to see what's going on. So there's that, as opposed to, look, there's cancer here. We got to get on this right now and do, you know, hit it just as hard as we possibly can. So this seems like there's sort of two separate issues. False positives would be one. And then if you do get a good diagnosis, what's appropriate treatment? That would be the other one.
Right. And I think part of the problem is the word cancer itself. And we want to understand what a particular cell looks like, and then what is going to be the biology of that condition, and we want to treat the patient as a whole. And one part that I didn't feel like the article went into very thoroughly, but that a big issue in the diagnosis of breast disease that they've been struggling with. And this is what we talked about when I believe that we did talk a couple of months ago when we talked about some of the changing guidelines with mammography, is as patients get older, they have other concerns with their health that may take precedence, and that if a very early breast condition is not going to manifest as a systemic clinical disease for literally more than a decade, if there are other clinical conditions that need to be the medical priority, do we need to proceed with very aggressive kinds of treatments? And also, there are so many patients with these very, very early conditions. How are we going to triage out those that are going to go on and have the most aggressive systemic disease versus those that will literally just stay as a very early contained condition?
Well, let me ask you another guy's question, because I'm sure that you would say, and people would say, that we have certainly improved the job that we do in identifying cancer early, and that's good. We have cut down the numbers of cancers, or at least maybe the possibility of surviving that is better. We catch it earlier, and maybe the main tool we have for that is the mammogram. And so a woman goes in for a mammogram, has a test, doctor sees something, said, okay, I'm concerned about this. So that what you have to do one way or another is you have to get some of that. You have to go to the area of concern. You have to get some of that so that you could look at it and say, is this cancer or is this not? Is it really so much? And I suppose we have talked about this in conjunction with cervical cancer. Is it really so much a matter of a judgment call? You get some tissue, you get some cells, and you put them on a microscope slide, and you put them on a microscope, and you look at them. Is it really so much of a judgment call whether what I'm looking at is cancer or not?
Well, that is what the histology is. And with breast cancer, we've proceeded a little bit farther than that, because we have these various stains and these various biology tests where we look at whether, for instance, they're estrogen receptor positive or negative, or progesterone receptor positive or negative. And so we have progressed beyond just the physical look. Mm-hmm. We have gone many steps beyond that. There are about 5 or 6 of these physical characteristics of a breast cancer cell that we look at to determine treatment, or I shouldn't say we, oncologists look at cancer doctors that specifically treat these patients. And as a gynecologist, it's not something that I specifically treat. It would be something that gynecologists would refer to treat. So at that step, no, they go beyond that. But it is definitely for the firm diagnosis. It is the step of the pathologist actually looking at the tissue to make the call.
Yeah. Okay.
So we still are at that stage.
Yeah.
Interestingly.
And it sounds like what you're saying, that if it's possible that a woman, you get that initial diagnosis, you want to have more than one opinion before you go any further than that and start thinking about, all right, what do you do about this? So you want to be as sure as you can be sure of the diagnosis in the first place before then you start thinking about treatment.
And that's what this article is saying, which is somewhat shocking, because as something that is so extraordinarily common, there are probably at least 2 million women walking around in the United States today with a diagnosis of breast cancer. So it's something so extraordinarily common, we don't generally think of breast cancer as a confusing diagnosis, mm-hmm. unlike certain things that are so extraordinarily rare that you would always think of getting a second opinion.
Yeah. All right. Our guest in this part of Focus is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She has practice in our area. She teaches at the U of I in the med school. And every other month, always on a Monday, she's on the program and we talk about women's health. And she always comes with a few things that are new. There have been some things in the news that have to do with women's health. She comes and talks a little bit about that, and we can answer questions about that. But more important, if there are anything that has to do with her area of practice, obstetrics and gynecology, and if you have a question, you can call and she will respond as best she can. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And you can also email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. So again, just to take this one step further, in addition to wanting to seek a second opinion about your diagnosis, then it seems that then once you get to that point of saying, well, yes, there is cancer, then maybe there still are going to be more than one approach to what to do once then you've made that diagnosis.
Yes, there probably is. Usually in respect to cancers, there are often some standard protocols. There are often many experimental protocols at CenterWatch has many clinical trials at clinicaltrials.gov. There are often nationally sponsored clinical trials. The Society for Gynecologic Oncologists, SGO.org, has a group of gynecologic oncologists that often have clinical protocols going on. And so if you would like to participate in something that is new and upcoming, that is often the best way to find out about those protocols. So there's been a tremendous amount of advances with the respect specifically to the treatment of breast cancer. Years ago, no one had a breast conservation, for instance, and now that is more common than the exception in terms of treatment of early breast cancers. So there's been a lot of progress.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, again, questions welcome. Yeah, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, we certainly, one of the things that we have talked a lot about over the years is C-sections. And the concern, certainly one thing we've talked about is the concern that I think that many physicians had that they were having too many of them. But this is now, this business of vaginal birth after C-section is something that, as you say, it's been in the news recently. And I think it seemed like we were at a time where it was pretty much just assumed that if you had one C-section, that the next time around you would have C-section again. Now, though, there seems to be, at least we're thinking more about, well, is it really possible for a woman to have one C-section to have a vaginal birth for the next time? And how do you evaluate your patients so that you could say to somebody, well, yeah, you had a C-section last time, but we think we can do it this way this time.
C-section rates have changed so radically. Probably in the 1950s, only about 3% of women in the United States had C-sections. And now there are parts of the country where over 50% of the births in any given hospital are by cesarean births. And nationally, we have a rate that's hovered a little bit over 30% for a long time. I think in our community, we probably are a little bit below that. But still, that's a very high rate of cesarean births, and a significant percentage are due to people having had one cesarean birth and therefore electing to have another cesarean birth. A few years ago, something very unheard of crept into the population, which was patients coming in and saying, well, I just don't select to have a vaginal birth. I would like to have a C-section. And so that added to the numbers right there. We also had a set of guidelines that crept into obstetrics practice that talked about what would be the best way to provide care for women who were undergoing labor and had had a prior cesarean section so that they could deliver safely. And those guidelines came out saying that should something go wrong, the hospital needed to provide an immediate cesarean delivery. And the verbiage that started to swirl around these cases led to a scenario that many smaller communities and smaller hospitals felt that they could not actually comply with the guidelines that said that you had to have essentially in-house obstetricians and in-house anesthesia people, so that at any moment in time, and in many cases it meant in-house pediatricians, so that what it essentially meant is if an otherwise healthy young woman was laboring, three physicians had to be there in attendance waiting, in some cases many hours, for her to deliver, not attending to any of their other work, because now they were just standing there in case something could go on. And, and you know, essentially that wording alone was the reason that many hospitals in smaller communities just said, okay, that's it. We're not going to do that. No one's going to pay us to sit here. And in fact, there is no mechanism for that. And so they just said, if you've had a previous cesarean birth, go somewhere else to deliver or schedule your C-section. And there are other hospitals that say, well, if and when on certain days we can provide that, you can have a vaginal birth. There are other hospitals where their malpractice companies have looked at potential risks and said, we're not going to cover you if you're going to provide cesarean births. I've seen articles like that in various literature that I read. So it's still become a controversial subject. Some patients have now had two cesarean births. And although there haven't been very many research studies looking at the safety of having a vaginal birth after you've had two cesarean births relative to what's your likelihood of having a complication such as a rupture of the uterus after you've had two cesarean births, the new statistics show it's really not that different. But again, statistically, hospitals are worried, so that many hospitals, even one of ours has a policy that essentially prohibits you to perform a VBAC if a patient has had two prior cesareans. Mm-hmm. So that if you happen to be delivering at that hospital, your physicians, even if they feel that it's something they would like to offer you, you would not be able to do that. So there are all these sort of hidden issues swirling around. And although the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists is trying hard to get these policies such to convince physicians to offer more VBACs in the trenches, it's just not really climbing the way they should be. When in fact, if a woman's had a prior cesarean birth, about 75% can expect to have a healthy VBAC the next time.
I have somebody who has a question here, and we'll get their question rather than asking mine. It's a caller in Paxton, in line number one. Hello.
Hey everyone. First of all, I want to thank Dr. Troopin. She delivered my son back in 92. And
great.
Again, yeah,
hope he's doing well.
A lot of wonderful stories I'm sure you have, and you are much appreciated by the community, and thank you for that. My question is, I am a 42-year-old male. My wife is 29, and we are trying to have a child. And she was on Depo-Provera for about 7 years, and we're having a heck of a time. And I'm not sure if my guys are still swimming or what exactly is going on. We've been trying. She's been off of it for, I want to say, at least 6 months plus. And I'm just wondering, when would it be the time to really get concerned and go in and get my sperm count checked and all that happy stuff? And just, you know, because we understand that Depo takes a while to, to work its way out and for her to get normal again. So I am unfortunately at work, and I got you guys on the headphones, so I'm going to jump off of here and listen, and I appreciate you. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you for the call.
Okay. And one thing I have been telling my couples just very recently is that we used to be able to order a sperm count on the guy when we were seeing the gal. And since females do not have sperm, that doesn't fly anymore with insurance companies. So we do a quick visit with the males, and we look at a couple of pregnancy planning factors in the males. We order his sperm count and a couple other hormone tests sometimes on the guys, get them started on vitamins just like we get the girls started. So we do a couple of pregnancy planning things on the guys as well, but I don't treat men. So once anything crops up abnormal, then we get them off to see their own physician or a specialist in infertility. But the traditional definition of infertility for women under the age of 35 is one full year of not being able to conceive, and the traditional definition of over 35 is 6 months of not being able to conceive. And those fertility ovulation detection kits that they sell, if someone's having regular cycles and they sell them at grocery stores and pharmacies, they're very accurate. And it can take over a year to become ovulatory after being on Depo-Provera. And it doesn't really matter if you were on for a few months or for 7 years. It really has more to do with the amount of suppression in your ovary itself. But it probably is true that being on a little bit longer statistically is a little bit more likely to be suppressed. So it's very common to take more than a year. And most insurance companies, if you're 29 and you haven't been trying for a full year, not going to cover too much in the way of fertility treatments. But generic clomiphene citrate, which is an ovulation-inducing medication, is really fairly inexpensive. And many couples will want to just sort of launch off on their own with an ovulation-inducing medication, and often that will be successful. Men make new sperm every 120 days. They're pretty fertile into their 60s and 70s, and maybe even longer than that. And it's usually the healthy sperm that wins the race, so age is not usually a big factor in terms of their fertility and birth defects, unlike women who are born with all the eggs they're ever going to have. So the older we get, the increase in the birth defects. But that still is not a significant problem until women get into their 40s.
Well, having said all that, though, are there particular things, easy things that can be done for men that can either increase their sperm count or do anything to make them more do their thing better?
Well, the old-fashioned wear boxer shorts and get more sleep and vitamins and decrease drinking, decrease smoking, all of those basic simple things, yes. They all work, just like for girls.
So basic, and probably they're all things that maybe you guys would be better off. They did aside from the underwear issue. The other kind of things, yeah, they'd probably be a good thing just on general principles. So,
right.
But that there are some things, simple things you could say, okay, here,
right.
Do these things, and that will increase
right.
your chances at least.
But
a
really
bit.
Knowing
non-invasive.
Knowing the sperm count is really probably the first easy step. And those semen analysis where they actually count more than the sperm, they count the volume. The semen analysis will count the volume. They will look at the morphology. They will look at the numbers of swimmers actually swimming in the right direction, things like that. So they actually look at 6 or 7 parameters. And those kinds of things probably predict more than all the good nights of sleep.
All right, very good. Our guest this morning in this hour is Dr. Suzanne Troopen. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. Her practice is the Women's Health Practice in Champaign. She's also teaching here at the U of I in the med school. And for a long time on this program, has been here on a regular basis. We do this every other month on a Monday, and it's a chance to call in, ask questions about women's health. And we've talked about a lot of different things. We talked about fertility and pregnancy and issues around birth. We've talked about breast cancer, other kinds of cancer. We have talked about osteoporosis. We've talked about menopause, all of those sorts of things. Anything that you could think of that she deals with in her practice, you can call and ask your question. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. I want to go back. We were talking before the caller called, and we were talking a little bit about C-section and the possibility that a woman, if she's had a C-section, the possibility that she could then, for her next delivery, have a vaginal delivery. And you talked about that, the fact that one of the changes that you had seen was that there seemed to be an increase in the numbers of women who were voluntarily having C-sections, who were coming and saying, this is the way that I want to do it. And so that makes me curious, well, why is it that a woman would just right off say, forget the vaginal birth, I want to do it this way?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons. There was actually a National Institute of Health conference on this, and it was interesting. It was headed up by a number of very well-respected obstetricians, and actually one of our local obstetricians, Dr. Mildred Nelson from Christie Clinic, did get a chance to participate and speak as a sort of a in-the-trenches obstetrician, so that was interesting. But we find that literally scheduling and family life, that's part of it. Fear is probably part of it. Definitely some of the trends in lack of birthing skills, for instance, the elimination of the delivery of vaginal breeches is sort of part of it. But whether that is truly a medical indication or a patient-driven indication, we could maybe argue about that. There's some consideration regarding pelvic floor preservation. So there's some information that if a woman avoids having a vaginal birth, that she's going to have less stress incontinence as she gets older. So people may choose to have a cesarean birth because of that. And there's some information regarding the reduced risk for the fetus in terms of reduced risk for shoulder dystocia. So it's just a combination of factors. And I would probably say control is one of them, and being able to say, I know when this is going to happen and how this is going to happen, and not that unknown of when I'm going to go into labor. And I think that must be a factor. Yeah. It still doesn't happen very often, thankfully, because I don't think it's the best thing.
That's the reason I think it's interesting, because I think that for a long time, when people talked about the increase in C-sections, the fault was laid at the door of doctors, and a lot of people are saying, well, it's the doctors, they're driving it, and it has to do with their convenience. They want to be able to schedule the birth. And it seems that, and I wonder how that stacks up as opposed to some women who are actually motivated by the same thing. It is about convenience, and they want to be able to schedule the birth.
Well, there must have been some convenience for the physician. There are also some studies that show, just in general in medicine, if something happens to you between eight in the morning and eight in the evening, you're a little more likely to have a good outcome than between eight in the evening and eight in the morning, because people do function better during the day than the night, and you have more staff there during the day than the night. And definitely, if we know some big issue is happening, some big medical problem, we do try to schedule it at a more convenient time with lots of help being ready and there to help us. So all of these factors definitely are a factor. We can look at other countries like Brazil that has had a 70% C-section rate, and there's some large communities in Brazil where basically physicians work until the early evening, and if you're not delivered, you get a cesarean birth, and that's part of the reason that those rates are crazy high. Mm. So convenience, it's part of it.
Okay, let's talk with somebody here on the phone in Tuscola, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm a 70-year-old male and about 10 years ago, I had prostate cancer and had the prostate glands removed by prostrocision. And recently, my partner and I were having sex, and it seemed after I withdrew that there was some ejaculate, and I didn't think that was possible once the prostate glands were removed. And obviously, my partner was concerned because she is still fertile and did not want to be pregnant. That isn't possible after one's prostate glands are removed, is it?
Well, you obviously need to check with your physician and figure out what secretions are going on. There are a number of glands, not just the prostate, that actually have secretions. And so you want to be sure that that's all that is going on. And there are ways to check and make sure that there's no sperm in whatever secretions are being emitted from whatever. They've actually, in certain people that have had certain kinds of surgery, been able to identify, for instance, sperm in urine, but they're never usually fertile. So even if there are just certain small amounts of secretion, it would be extremely unlikely to be fertile per se. But definitely, if it's something new, you want to be sure what's going on medically as well as a contraception issue.
Okay, thank you. So it, what you're saying is that
it would be unlikely.
It's not clinically impossible.
Well, and, you know, whenever they do these resections for cancer, they're removing what they see, but some cancers have little tongs and things that may or may not have all been resected, and you can have growths and recurrences, so you want to be sure what's going on.
Okay, but I guess my question was, is there enough secretion without the prostate gland that sperm could be carried?
It wouldn't be very likely. But I guess it wouldn't be impossible, but it would be highly unlikely.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Our guest this morning in this part of Focus is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She's an obstetrician and a gynecologist. We talk about women's health with her every other month, and that's what we're doing here. We have maybe about 6 or 7 minutes left. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good, any way that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Have we pretty much done C-section?
I think we've pretty much done C-section, and I know we were gonna. I was going to talk briefly about some of the new guidelines in terms of the safety of medications in pregnancy. They are what's going on right now is a big study of. Many women who have taken medications between the year 2000 and about, I think, 2007, 2008, and looking at a very large database and the outcome with respect to birth defects and trying to tag certain medication use to certain birth defects. Unfortunately, this is going to be a retrospective study. As we know with retrospective studies, they're not as accurate as prospective studies, but bottom line is that certain medications are popping up as possibly associated with birth defects. For instance, macrodantin, which is more commonly used for the treatment of urinary tract infections, is popping up as a little bit more likely to be associated with certain birth defects than, say, penicillins, which could also be used for the treatment of urinary tract infections. So it may have impact on how we treat infections in pregnancy. And they are gradually changing the descriptive guidelines as to how they are describing the safety of medications in pregnancy. So women who have been pregnant before and been prescribed medication, this may impact on how what their physicians are telling them or what kind of verbiage they're seeing on their medication guidelines. So there are going to be changes just because of the way the guidelines are changing, not necessarily that much new information. and people shouldn't worry so much. They should check with their individual providers. And I think that as this new study is done, we will have a lot more new information. Mm-hmm. But it will lead to a lot of changes.
Mm-hmm. So you think that there will be more restrictions than there are now?
I think there'll be changes. I think actually it'll go both ways. I think some things will be a little more restrictive. I think some areas will be a little less restrictive as we've had so many new medicines introduced, and some of them we've been withholding from pregnant patients just because we haven't had information, or been very sparingly used in pregnant patients because we haven't had information. Now that they're going to be able to use this large database to get information, I think that we'll be able to use these medications a little bit more comfortably. So I think it'll go both ways.
Okay. Well, you said, I think at the beginning, maybe that it was there something new in the area of birth control that you want to talk about?
Yes, there are. They just released a new quadriphasic birth control pill. So women who are still having spot bleeding or a lot of breakthrough bleeding or side effects from their birth control pill, there's another choice, which many women run out of patience a little bit before we run out of choices. But there is another new choice in terms of contraception. So I think that is a good thing. There are many new studies being done. We're not quite ready to start our newest study, but we will be studying a new patch, which is exciting. There's only one birth control patch on the market, and we're going to be studying a new patch. So hopefully someday there'll be more than one patch on the market, and we'll be recruiting for that study hopefully in the next few weeks. So that will be exciting. We're also involved in new research studies on the treatment of uterine fibroids and polyps and endometriosis. So a lot of new work going on in gynecology.
Hmm. I'm just curious, what can you say now about the popularity of oral contraceptive that's being taken? And we've talked about this, where women essentially take the pill for 3 months or 4 months or what it is. So rather than having the pill designed so that you continue to have a period every month, that you go maybe 3-4 months without having a period.
Well, I think a couple of years ago, it's actually been a little bit more than a couple of years ago when some of the new longer cycle pills came out. We were predicting that no one would take pills such that they were still having 12, 13 cycles per year. And many women still are on those kinds of pills where you take active pills for 21 days and actually cycle then once every about 28 days. But many women are not. And the popularity of long cycle pills has continued to climb. And many women are now feeling more comfortable with that concept and understanding that there is no medical need to shed the lining of the uterus actually every 28 days, and that, in fact, there's no medical need to shed the lining of the uterus for many years if, in fact, you're on a hormonal combination that allows for that lining to be thin all the time. So the popularity of long cycle pills has increased and increased. And we find that with long cycle pills, women are less likely to have moodiness. They're less likely to have any PMS symptoms. They are more likely to have better protection with contraception, so fewer escape ovulations. They're less likely to have what we call hormone withdrawal symptoms. So in that pill-free week, they're less likely to have the bloating and breast tenderness and headaches that some women were having on the 21-7 pills. So absolutely, the longer cycle pills are gaining in momentum in terms of market share and popularity.
Okay. Well, we'll leave it at that for this time around. Our guest, Dr. Suzanne Truppen, is an obstetrician and gynecologist. Her business is practice is the Women's Health Practice in Champaign. She also teaches at U of I every other month. She's here always on a Monday. We talk about women's health. Thanks very much.
Thank you.